Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hi, my name is Elvis Costello, and I feel splendiferous about being Conan O'Brien's friend.
Oh, that's lovely. That's really lovely.
Splendiferous.
I knew you wouldn't just give me a run-of-the-mill word.
Fall is here, hear the yell, back to school, ring the bell, brand new shoes, walking blues, climb the fence, books and pens. I can tell that we are gonna be friends. Yes, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
Hello and welcome to Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. I'm doing my best to have a mellifluous tone, smooth and professional. I'm trying to sound like other people I've heard on podcasts and the radio, and I'm in my head now. But I can't help it. I'm Conan O'Brien. I'm here to please. And I hope you enjoy this audio infotainment. I'm joined, as always, by Sonam Avsesyan, my trusty assistant.
Hi.
And also sitting in with us, Sona's assistant. And boy, is that absurd, because he basically does all the work that
he does.
Sona refuses to do. David Hopping, how are you, David?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. What's happening?
I have a bone to pick.
Oh, now how could you? You've been on maternity leave for, I think, 4 years.
Three months.
Yeah, it's weird. For the last 3 months, things have been very efficient in my life. Everything taken care of. Good work, David.
Oh, thank you.
David stepped forward and just started helping me on doing things that you refused to do.
Yeah.
And so I'm stunned that you have a bone to pick with me, because I think you've had a pretty— Yes, you've been on the gravy train now for 3 months.
Okay. Well, first of all, that's a separate thing I have to like complain about. Is that it's not the gravy train. I'm a mom. I'm taking care of two babies now. So
I was one of six. And my mom used to put us all in the kitchen, throw a boiled ham into the center of the room, and say, good luck to you all. I'm out.
Okay.
So tell me about your play.
So I can't say that I listened to all of the podcasts while I was gone.
Sure. Why should you?
But you guys released this whole segment about my FOMO. And you're like, oh, we're going to, you know, and you was when
FOMO, by the way, for anyone who doesn't know, fear of missing out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you were, you know, talking about going to Sugarfish and sending me pictures and stuff. And then you're like, we're going to do all the things that Sona loves to do. And all you could think of was going to see Thunder from Down Under, the male strip show in Vegas.
Yes.
Drinking white wine and getting high.
Yeah.
So is that all you think of me?
That is 98% of what I think of you.
Okay, that's fair.
No.
You watch TV.
What's that?
You watch TV.
Yeah, you watch TV, but you do enjoy the male body. You used to obsess over any show that depicted men in all of their masculine glory.
Obsessed?
Gigolos.
Yeah, you watched the show Gigolos.
Oh, yeah, I did.
And you used to love your favorite movie that you would talk about all the time was—
Magic Mike?
Magic Mike. And when there was a sequel— You pretty much made me take you and a bunch of your lady friends to see the Magic Mike sequel.
Yeah.
Which—
The midnight showing.
Yeah.
As soon as it came out, we
as
went.
As soon as it came out.
Yeah.
And so you love that. You loves your wine.
I do loves my wine. I know.
We have a picture that was hanging in our office for years of me in the background being swarmed by fans that wanted pictures, and they were just like lining up, and I was taking pictures of people. And you're in the foreground ignoring me with the biggest pour of Chardonnay I've ever seen. Just a massive glass. And you're sipping it and not helping me in any way. And it was a candid photo. It wasn't a gag photo. It was a candid photo.
It was. You know what? Now that you bring all that up, it's
you
pretty,
also
it's
couldn't
fair.
Live without your gummies.
It's fair. Okay, relax. I can live without gummies.
No. Since you became pregnant, you stopped.
Yeah.
And...
And you're right. It is a really tough time for me.
Aw.
Is it? Do you miss it?
I miss it so much. And I think, oh, maybe I'll just have like half of one. But then I'm like, oh, what if I sleep through one of the babies crying and like needing me for something? And so I don't do it. But I think about it a lot. So you know what? Maybe you were right.
You know, my wife, of course, we have two kids. And in the early years, her thing was that our bedroom door always had to be open in case somebody cried. And then, of course, they got older and they stopped crying and they'd sleep through the night. And then they got even older. But always, door always open in case anybody needs anything, anything's going on.
Yeah.
Now my children are, you know, 18 and about to be 16. My son's like 6'3". Still, door cracked open. What if he needs us? What if he needs us? If he needs us, he'll smash through his bedroom wall and then he'll come smashing through our bedroom wall because he's 6'4 and like 185 pounds. What do you mean if he needs us? If he needs us, he'll pick up his bed, throw it out the window.
Oh my God.
You know, it's just insane.
Well, it's in case you need him now.
I know, but she's never going to, you know, when they have their own kids and they're visiting us, she's still going to, and we're like 110 years old.
Yeah.
She's going to be like, we've got to keep the bedroom door open in case they need us. Who needs us? Those people in their 50s. What would we do? How would I help them? Would I rip off one of my legs and hand it to them so they could use it as a crutch? Because I can pull it off right now. I'm that withered and old. It's absurd. Madness.
I was like, you couldn't think of anything else. And I'm like, is that all you think
of me? No, you're a caricature.
Yeah.
I defend most humans and I say, well, they're complex. They're three-dimensional. I can make a couple of jokes, but I really can't reduce them to anything cartoonish. Because that's not fair to them. But Sona, it's so great because you really are a two-dimensional drawing that likes your wine, your gummies. You love your Armenian snacks.
Yeah.
And you love to watch male strippers do their thing. Nothing wrong with that.
I'm a simple person.
Yes.
And I love came that this in started, hot. Yeah.
I love that this started with you having a beef with us and then immediately admitting that you were in the wrong and that we are right.
It was accurate.
The important thing is you came to Sugarfish, though, last week.
I did.
We did have, now, Sugarfish, I always explain things because I don't know if people know.
Yeah.
Sugarfish is an amazing sushi chain, and there's one right near the podcast studio, and Sugarfish sushi is one of Sona's favorite things. Mm-hmm. And so I've been taking David there.
It's been great.
Because you've been home with
your kids. I never had it until...
Oh, no, you've never... I mean, first of all, David...
Oh here we go.
No, I'm being honest here. David, a man of humble means. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that in a kind and gentle way.
Okay.
I don't think you are.
No. Okay. David's idea of good eats is, three sticks of beef jerky. And he gets to drink the whole Sprite. And so I took you to Sugarfish and you couldn't believe it. You're like, oh, this tastes so good. And look, they've actually got silverware on the table.
Okay.
He got all excited. And there was a toilet there in the restaurant you could use.
Dang it.
And but anyway, it was a big deal for you. Admit that.
I will say, the rice was warm.
The rice was warm, yeah. He just loved it, and we kept doing it. And so I said, we started taking photographs and sending them to Sona, who is home.
Yeah.
Spoon-feeding your kids whatever they eat now.
Spoon-feeding
already?
Are they eating solid food yet?
No. They're 3 months old.
I forget. I completely forget what age that happens.
I think that for us, we're probably going to start doing that at like 6, I think.
I remember very clearly the first time we fed my daughter solid food. I remember sitting at this little table, just watching it happen. And it's just seeing her expression as she was like, what is this?
Yeah. And do you remember what you fed her?
It was saltwater taffy.
On a spoon?
With very sharp nuts in it.
No.
We were told later on it was a mistake. No, it was some kind of mashed mush. I forget what it was. Mm-hmm. Some, you know, but anyway, seeing someone, a human being experience for the first time solid food.
Yeah.
And just their mind explodes. It's just incredible.
Everything for the first time.
I remember when you took your first gummy. Wow.
You weren't there.
I was there.
No, you weren't.
It's incredible.
I was happy.
I had a time machine.
I was happy. Oh.
All right. Well, enough blither and blather. We have big show today. Big, big show. Very excited. My guest today is a Grammy award-winning singer-songwriter and member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's recorded 31 studio albums over the course of his career. And his latest project, How to Play Guitar and Why, is part instruction manual, part memoir, and available now on Audible. I'm a huge fan of this gentleman. I listened to this instruction manual slash memoir, and I absolutely loved it because I have my own fascination with the guitar and with this gentleman and his music. I am thrilled he's with us today. Elvis Costello, welcome. You're one of my favorite people to talk to, and one of my all-time favorite artists. So to get to sit here with you and have a thoughtful conversation for 6 hours, did they tell you it's 6 hours?
Yeah, I brought a little bit of Kendall mint cake to sustain me.
You also, we have a jar you can urinate into at any point.
Thank you.
If that becomes,
well, I carry one all the time anyway.
Well, I saw that. And it looks sad, Elvis. Yeah. You said splendiferous, and I was listening to, I don't know how to describe it. It's absolutely lovely. How to Play the Guitar and Why. It's available on Audible. And I was listening to it, and it is, of course, because it's you, it's not what one might expect. Yes, you do talk about how one might approach the guitar, but it's also this tone poem about everything. And you write, no surprise, beautifully. And you have such great images in there. And I'm reminded that anytime I go to the UK, if I go to London, especially if I go to Ireland, anybody I talk to has this lovely, lovely way of speaking and this command.
I think that's really confirmed by watching the movies of Guy Ritchie.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, right.
Seriously.
I mean, there's some very creative swearing. You've got to be able to.
Oh my God.
Swear creatively if you live in England.
Yes. Right? Not just the swearing.
And the punching and biting too.
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful punching. Beautiful biting.
And headbutting.
Yeah. And of course, I've always loved your lyrics and the way they interconnect and the architecture of your lyrics. But listening to this, it's so funny. And you have these great images that stick with me. You talk about the wonders of the E minor chord and how evocative it can be. And then you talk about how it's like the lantern on a miner's helmet in a deep cave. And I thought, okay, damn it, this guy's good. That is exactly what it is.
Well, thank you. I was trying to treat this, I called it a work of comic philosophy. It might be flattering a little bit to say it's philosophical, but I don't think anybody would trust me to actually give them a music lesson. Just listen to the way I play the guitar. I make the point that it's important to keep the inner idiot alive within yourself, particularly if you're going to play rock and roll guitar. You don't want to know what every note is.
Right.
That's where some of the, you know, they're called happy accidents, not unhappy accidents.
Right.
You want to be able to surprise yourself. Sometimes surprise other people in a bad way by the horrible noise you're making. But the point of this ramble, narrative, whatever you would call it, how to play the guitar and why, is to try and get people past that inhibition to make a mistake that'll lead them to the pleasure of playing a song simply. You can go and study music formally from page one of the theory book, and it'll take you very logically through it. But the point I make is that the piano is laid out like a diagram. Mm-hmm. It is a beautiful diagram, and all the order of music and the chaos of music is there at a glance. When you pick up a guitar, much as if you pick up any blown instrument, it's not apparent. You it's facing away from you for one thing, so you're always looking at your hands initially. And I'm trying to just prove the point that When you begin in the key of C, which many, many instructional books of my childhood did because they were married to musical mm-hmm, theory, mm-hmm. You struggle to play that lovely ringing C chord. You get that under your hands, and you immediately encounter the chord of F. And the yes. chord of F is nearly impossible for every novice. And it is, truthfully, as I say in the piece, the reason why the world is not full of happy minstrels, but in fact, I mean, when I say, I don't mean minstrels as in the old horrible sense, I yes. mean strolling players.
Yes.
But is, and is actually filled with sadistic dentists and dictators, and they, all of whom have encountered the chord of F, and it threw them down a path of, you know, they thought this pain that was inflicted on their soul, they were going to inflict on other people evermore.
This is why I thought, when I was listening to this, I thought Elvis is talking directly to me for two reasons. One, I'm a narcissist. So I always think when I listen to a great man or great woman speak that they're speaking directly to me.
And I was, of course.
Yes, I know. Yeah. It says dedicated to Conan O'Brien, yeah. which I lovely sentiment. Yeah. And then the second thing is I took up the guitar probably rather late for most people. I'd started as a terrible drummer, and then I decided when I got out to Los Angeles to start my comedy career. I am in comedy, by the way.
Yes, yes.
Just want to make that clear.
Yes.
I have to tell people all the time because it's not—
No.
It's not apparent.
No.
But
I've warned you about being taller than me.
I know, you always say that. But it's what I decided was I need a solo instrument. I need to learn to play the guitar. So I went to Freedom Guitar, which was basically a pawn shop here in Hollywood, and I purchased a 1970s era Yamaha acoustic guitar, mm-hmm. and I purchased the Mel Bay chord book.
Well, that's exactly the kind of chord book that I'm talking about, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I quickly realized I don't want to learn theory. I don't understand theory. Theory scares me. What I want to do is play the songs that I love to hear. And I remember very clearly, if you start in C, you've got to then go to F and then to G.
Yeah.
That's just the way it goes.
That's the three-chord trick that will yield many, many songs.
The problem is, as you point out, F, F for a novice, and even for if you're not a novice, yeah. a proper F requires you to contort your hand in a way that causes it to explode.
It also causes you to exclaim and add three other letters to that initial F. And, you know, that it truthfully yeah. does. Frequently followed by hurling the said instrument across the room,
yeah.
dashing it to pieces, which is, as I say, why the world is full of frustrated F's.
Yes.
You know, the people that struggle never get further than F. Now, so it seems like I'm giving the game away. I want to take people down the trail. There's lots of other things I say. I want to take people down the trail in how to play the guitar and why. If you sort of imagine yourself learning C and you logically have to find F as the next chord, if you then allow yourself the luxury of learning the chord of G,
yes,
you're immediately ahead of the game, because if you switch to the key of G, the chord of C is that second chord you're going to need.
Yes.
That means you already know it.
Yes.
So you have that wonderful feeling, hey, I'm halfway there. The chord of D is actually a very simple
very
triangle
easy.
Of fingers, probably the simplest chord on the whole fretboard, certainly in the first positions. And at that point, I would say most relatively nimble-fingered people can learn to play that sequence of chords, albeit haltingly. And that's why I recommend that you simply play the guitar for yourself, maybe watching anything. You know, you could be watching something improving. You could be watching some dreadful history show or something much more sinister or seedy.
Yeah.
But whatever hypnotizes
you. Suggesting pornography?
No, you suggested pornography.
Suggest
that was, it. Nothing could be further.
I don't know what you're doing later.
Nothing could be further from that. But the point being that what you can have your neighbor come and talk to you, particularly if he's a boring person, then you don't, you know, really listen.
Right.
You can do anything. If you teach yourself just to move your fingers until it becomes natural. One of the things that I had to kind of think of again as I was trying to get to put myself in the mind that I was in when I first learned, assuming that he started in the key of G, and these first two positions were actually relatively simple. It was that mistake that people make, is to lift the whole hand from the guitar in between the chord. You really don't need to do that. You're not about to put it down. Keep your hand just above the strings. And after a while, you notice that your hand will just slip across into that position. And before you know where you are, you're playing music. And my thinking in writing all of this is to find an amusing way of saying, this is actually easier than you think.
Yes.
And then you get to three chords, and we get to the wonderful illumination of the minor chord, in the case of G, the E minor that creates the da 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 da, a million songs based on that chord sequence. After that, it's really up to you. It's up to your own curiosity. You might go on to write a symphony, and you might go back and learn all that musical theory. You might take up another instrument, or you might be content with those three chords, because so many wonderful songs lie within the three or four chord range, and add sevenths to color those chords, and gradually your chord inventory, so to speak, will just grow.
And you talk about this in How to Play the Guitar and Why. You reference Hank Williams, one of the great American songwriters of all time. They call him the Shakespeare of the South. And
he's the Shakespeare of everywhere.
Well, that's Shakespeare may disagree with that. Where is Shakespeare if we say that Hank Williams is Shakespeare?
It's true.
He's fucked.
It's true. Well, he's long gone. He's not that bothered now. But
you're right. You're right. Right. Yeah. Hank is only recently gone.
I do think Hank Williams is for everybody. You know, I mean, you have to, as I point out, one of Hank Williams' first national hits was Cold Cold Heart.
Yes, yes.
But it was Cold Cold Heart, a song by Tony Bennett.
Yes.
So he was immediately put himself in. I've always argued, when people talk about the Great American Songbook, It's wonderful that we celebrate George Gershwin and Cole Porter, but you can't leave out Willie Dixon. You can't leave out Hank Williams.
Nope.
These are the other American music. You can't leave out Jelly Roll Morton. There's just dozens and dozens of songwriters that we should be grateful they thought of that idea, whatever it is. Hank Williams wrote so many unbelievable songs based on three chords. And I chose deliberately a Hank song because it's such an emotional song that I think from the outside, you would imagine it must be more complex musically in order to render this feeling. But I try to strike the balance in writing the piece and then performing it between genuine instruction, which there is a little bit of genuine instruction, and heartfelt feeling for songs like Cold Cold Heart. And I think you mentioned the fact that I'm clearly not American, so I've come to appreciate musicians like Hank Williams, or for that matter, Willie Dixon and countless others from America, from the perspective of somebody who grew up on English radio.
Yes.
Musically and comedically. Because I think that I might be right in saying radio comedy remained recognizable in a form that my parents would have known, with just changes of personality. Whereas those same performers in America became television entertainers, because television took hold in America much earlier.
Yes.
So the people who I didn't know anything about when I first came to America, I knew who Lucille Ball was. I knew who Phil Silvers was because I really loved Sergeant Bilko. I had never seen Jackie Gleason until I set foot in America.
Right.
I might have seen his name in a movie cast list, but I didn't know how revered he was from The Honeymooners.
Yeah.
Well, the equivalents of those shows in England were on the radio.
Yes.
So, of course, they contained all of the surreality of much more use of sound effects. What American television comedy achieved with slapstick, they had to achieve with sound effects, which is why I was attracted to writing the score, you know, accompanying myself throughout this piece in the spirit of BBC radio comedy, really.
You know? How to Play the Guitar and Why, you're taking people on this journey that was very inspiring for me, to the point where when you were talking about Cold Cold Heart and talking about the power of it, I went and got my guitar. It's three chords and played along and realized I could have played this song 3 months into learning the guitar and felt just as
powerful and lovely as I do playing it now all these years later, that's how simple it is. Yeah. And you're playing Hank Williams. The power is all there.
I know. I've never really understood, you know, like why... I mean, some of the songs that they teach you in that kind of play in a day book, which was very common when I was a kid, they weren't very interesting songs. So they didn't push you on.
No.
If it's a song that you really love, you have that desire to find out what the chord is that links those phrases together. And little by little, that becomes a way to learn harmony. You know, you start to hear, if you have any kind of natural ear for music, you're going to eventually become curious that you'll try to play a song and the few chords that you do know will not render it. And that's when maybe you have to consult some sort of dictionary of chords, and you little by little start to piece the elements of harmony, which a piano trained student, of course, is taken through. But very few people are taught to play just chord shapes on the piano.
Right.
They're immediately the independence of the hands playing melody in one hand, bass line in the other, or chords in the left hand, isn't the same as playing the guitar, where you have a choice between learning scales and, say, you wanted to be Eddie Van Halen. You could practice and practice and practice till you got as fluid as half the speed of some of the solos that he played. But you could only play that solo at the end of all that study. It wouldn't lead you back to a full song. My method is taking you from the song, and then you eventually you're going to know for yourself whether it's in you to want to be that kind of person that cuts loose and finds those other things higher up the neck of the guitar. That's all very thrilling. That's a different study. That's why I don't go into it that much.
You know, it's funny because I'm reminded that John Lennon and Paul McCartney were steadfast about not wanting people, they didn't want to know what the hell they were doing.
Yeah.
They very much clearly had this incredible facility with music, and they had their 10,000 hours of playing, and they had the ambition and the creativity, but they didn't want to sit down with someone and have them explain musical theory. And yet, look at the body of work is there. So they approached it in the way you're talking about, which is sheer enthusiasm.
Like a song like Michelle, which has some diminished chords in it, which would be much more common to the language of jazz musicians. They must have, I don't know, maybe because the song had this French theme, maybe they heard some music that contained these other voicings of chord, and it's only one note different, you know, in the chord, and it just opens a door. It is like colors.
Yes.
There are people talking colors when they're talking music. But I tried not to get, I did sort of try to lay out the musical theory aspect of this in a way that was funny, so that it didn't become indigestible for somebody that simply was curious to know what I felt about it, because the last part of the title is the why they're playing the guitar. Like, some people just like, you look good holding an instrument. You know,
yes.
People will say, well, you know, the piano player's hidden behind a piano. That's not kind of going to help me communicate with people. If you have something that you have to blow through, a saxophone or a trumpet, then you can't sing. You maybe can't you can't really smile while you're playing those instruments. You have to concentrate. You can smile when you take it away from your mouth, but if you're a singing soloist.
Right.
So the guitar is obviously it's the show-off's instrument.
I used to think I was shallow. Well, I am shallow, but yeah. I used to really think that I was shallow because when I started on the acoustic, then I got my first electric guitar, which for you nerds out there was a Gretsch Tennessean.
Woo.
Yeah.
Pretty fancy.
1964 Gretsch Tennessean that I got for $600 at the time.
Wow.
Which today would be worth a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
And it's the same guitar that George Harrison played on their second US tour. But I'll stop there. It goes too far and it's really sad. But I started to work on that guitar, and then I realized I cared more about the look than the sound of the electric guitar. So I liked a big Gretsch, and people would say, well, do you like the tone? And I'd say, I really don't know. I just know that when I'm holding a big Eddie Cochran Gretsch, I think it looks cool. Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about with tone.
Well, I did. I can really sympathize with that because I went a stage further than that when I was a lot younger than I imagine you were, if you could afford a $600 guitar. My first ever group I formed with my childhood best friend, a man who was like a brother to me, Joel Peterson, and we had a group called the Meteors, which consisted of one of us hitting a biscuit tin with knitting needles and the other playing what was a very impressive cardboard replica of a Rickenbacker, or sometimes I'd have a bass modeled on a Hofner, cut out of cardboard boxes, glued together. And then we would hide a record player behind a curtain and we would play Freddie and the Dreamers and mime along to this. This was like a preparation for a life in show business anyway, because half the time on the BBC, they didn't allow you to actually sing when I became a professional musician. So this mime or lip sync, as you call it in America, was a perfect preparation. But it was all about making the cardboard replica, a flat cardboard replica of the guitar. I mean, I hasten to add, I was only 26 when I was doing this, so it's not as pitiful as it sounds. You know? No, I was
at the time you were 52.
Yeah, I was 52 while I was doing it.
And you could afford a guitar, but you had gone quite mad.
Yeah, I still preferred with the cardboard.
Yeah.
And the cardboard guitars, of course, were not that resilient to the kind of shape throwing, as we call it in, I don't know whether you call it that over here, the kind of shape throwing that one has to affect while playing the guitar. So any kind of posing with the guitar would immediately bend the rather thinner piece of cardboard that had been cut out to fashion the neck. Now, I felt really as if I was in command of the music because I never made any mistakes while giving doing
you can't.
Before. You can't because the music was
there's
coming,
no strings.
It's coming from behind a curtain.
Yeah.
But it confirms what you're saying about how good it feels to hold a certain kind of guitar. I remember buying a Gretsch on, I think, my second tour of America. I bought a Gretsch White Falcon, and I thought, all I need is the fringe jacket now, and I'll look just like Neil Young.
Yeah.
And all it did was feed back all the way through the first show that I tried to play it on, and I never played it again. I just immediately went back to the shop. I just couldn't get along with it.
The White Falcon, for anyone listening, and it's going to be a lot of you who don't know, it's Mike Nesmith played one when he was with the Monkees. So if you go back and look at an old Monkees episode, it's this giant white guitar.
Gold and fittings and everything.
From a distance, it's gold and it's got jeweled insets and it's got a big falcon and it's the most amazing thing. When you get up close.
It's not going to like a thing with a big falcon on it, you know, like, I mean, that's the essential part of anything.
Exactly.
Really, everything, big falcon.
Everything should have a large falcon on it.
Yeah, I always, you know, carry one at all times, you know.
You walked in with a large falcon.
Yeah.
And we immediately subdued
it. Put it in a cage.
But when you get up close and look at those guitars, they're actually very garish. When you get close, it's like seeing a clown, but from like 2 inches away. It's horrifying.
Which is never good.
Never good.
No. No, unless that's actually a very frightening childhood memory. You've just summed up now. In fact, I have to leave. I think maybe I was attracted to it because my first electric guitar was a Vox, and it wasn't a cool Vox either. It was the name Vox attached to this Les Paul copy I bought in Frank Hesse's shop, which is quite a famous shop for people. The Beatles fans will know that.
Yes.
You know, that will know this name. It sort of lurks in the Beatles mythology because it's where George Harrison bought his first guitar, I think. When I lived in Liverpool in the early 70s, I would go there and try all the guitars on the rack, even the ones I couldn't afford. They had this Rickenbacker that used to have a white card stuck between the strings, said, formerly owned by George Harrison. And I would occasionally pluck up the courage to ask to play it, even though I couldn't afford it. And it would disappear as if it was bought by people. And I think in the end, I got just good enough on the guitar to recognize that it was a really horrible guitar. It was a Rickenbacker, but there was a good reason why George got rid of it. It was just not a good one.
So you think it's true? You think it did belong to George?
Oh, I think it probably did, but he probably would say, you know what, Frank, take this back. And I bought this Vox for exactly those reasons. It had fake gold fittings.
Yes, the look.
It weighed a ton.
The
it
look.
It sounded absolutely horrible. And, you know, I struggled on that for a number of years until I found a combination of a clip-on pickup with an acoustic guitar that actually sounded funkier than my actual electric guitar.
And you ended up, I think what's very hard to do, you really know you've made it when you can name the artist and name their guitar. And the two go together. It's Lennon, the Rickenbacker, and it's McCartney, Hofner, and it's, you know, Brian Jones in that teardrop, that white teardrop.
Vox.
Yeah. And you and the Fender Jazzmaster. Like, just that guitar, I just, whenever I see anybody with that guitar, I think, what are you doing with Elvis Costello's guitar?
Well, I that's very nice of you to say, but I think I have to give credit. I was playing I graduated to a Telecaster. I had a friend who worked for a Fender showroom and managed to get me a little bit of discount on a Fender. And I played a brand new Fender for a long while, which wasn't, again, not a very good guitar. And I saw this Jazzmaster in a secondhand shop covered in furniture varnish. It was very unattractive in its original appearance. And I had seen a guitar player from Cincinnati, Ohio, called Danny Adler, mm-hmm. who was playing in a group in London at the time. And he impressed me because he could play the guitar part from Clean Up Woman, the Betty Wright record, Little Beaver, the guitar player from Miami. And I'd never heard anybody play that kind of funk kind of rhythm guitar so well in person. And I thought, well, that's a bit of a different kind of sounding thing. It's got a... So I have to credit him really as the person that I saw play it first. I think you'd get a few people who would lay claim to that guitar other than me. Tom Verlaine of Television played one. I know that Fender put out several models named for artists long before they got around to remaking my one. I mean, it was only about 10 or 12 years ago that they made a small run. But I think really the mistake that they made was to recreate my guitar with its original, can I say, ship brown furniture branch look. It sounded actually really good, but it looked like hell, you know. And I don't really see any young kids, what I really need a guitar that's going to make me look cool. I think I'll have one that looks like the color of a roadkill, you know.
That's what it exactly. Looks like. Yeah. I want a fecal look to my guitar.
Yeah, that's what's going to make me a hit with the girls and the boys.
Justin and so good. Thousands of summer deals at your Nordstrom Rack store. Save up to 60% on new arrivals from Vince, Rag & Bone, Adidas, Joe's, Marc Jacobs, and more. Great brands, great prices every day at Nordstrom Rack. But hurry for first dibs. Get your summer favorites up to 60% off at Nordstrom Rack today. Great brands, great prices. That's why you rack.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Listening to this Audible book that you made, first of all, it's lovely to listen to. You have this great melodic speaking voice. So it's very... seductive. Listen to this.
Several of them, it has been pointed out.
Yes.
Several of them.
Yeah.
This was pointed out to me by Scott Sherritt, who produced the audiobook version of my memoir, mm-hmm. Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. And when I began talking, the first couple of chapters were set in Liverpool. And when I start to talk about Liverpool, I start to sound like my mother a little bit more. And then the third day I was recording, I had a passage where I had to say, well, I was born in a street that my first home when I was a child, mm-hmm. a baby, was in a street that had one of the blue plaques that commemorates famous people that lived in that street. Now, this was a very modest street. We lived in a basement mm-hmm. of a boarding house. By this point, the neighborhood had gone to hell. We had moved in. There's the clue. But at some point, Sir Edward Elgar had lived, probably mm-hmm. when these houses were... you know, dedicated to one family living in a four story building, not broken down into little bedsits. And I started to speak like this. I said, on that morning, I
got up and the horse-drawn milk float came round early in the morning and parked next to the Morris Minor. And I suddenly started to sound like David Niven. And I didn't know how to stop doing it. And it's happened to me a few times. Yes. I get on a microphone and something comes over me. My wife Diana and I did a season where we played cartoon cats for Pete the Cat. And on the day that I was playing Pete's father, I had a cold. And it, when I spoke on the microphone, it sort of pitched my voice very high. And I started to speak like David Beckham. I say things like, Pete.
He's way up here.
Can you go in the garage and get my wrench? And of course, it was fine. They all loved it. And nobody told me to stop. And then when I went back like a month later to do the next episode, I couldn't do the voice.
Right.
I mean, clearly anybody that's ever seen me act knows that some things that I do border on acting. Not close enough to the border, but they border on acting, you know. But then something happens when I start to read things that I've written down. I find I can hear my voice changing in the headphones. And I think it's just the excitement of what I'm talking about. And
sure.
The idea of hitting the guitar like that, I'm seeing John Lennon's stance when I'm saying it. So I start to speak like the more in the parts of my voice that really come from Liverpool, you know. I hope that people don't think that it's insincere because I change my voice a little bit.
My assumption was that you were a sociopath.
Well, that
you
had no, as well.
You had no core personality.
I don't have any core personality. What,
you just a dot.
Just a dot and...
you know, just, whoever you're with, and I mean, you've and become the, and me,
the,
pretty
and
much.
And the well of hatred.
Yeah.
That obviously is apparent from the torture that I like to put people through in this.
No, it's really fantastic. And I learned so much. And I'm such a fan of yours that I thought, well, I'm not going to really pick up anything new about Mr. Costello here. And then I find out that you always wanted to be a songwriter first.
Yeah.
And not a performer, which I can't believe I didn't know, because I think every youngster comes at it thinking, I want to be the rock and roll god. I want to be the one on stage with the guitar. It really surprised me that you came at it thinking, I want to be a songwriter, and then it led to this.
I think it's explained by two things. One of them is from very, very early experience of music as a child watching, knowing that my mother sold records. Mm-hmm. And I knew that one of the things that she had to do in those days was to be able to recommend more than one version of a song. People didn't think in terms of covers. They thought in terms of interpretations of songs. So if you were going to be good at selling records, you needed to know the difference between recommending Frank Sinatra or Victor Moan's rendition of the song, which not just down to whether that person even liked it. People would quite often come in and sing to my mother in the shop, she told me. Like, they come in, do you have this? And they go, and they wouldn't know any of the words. They wouldn't know the title of the song. And they would just sing the melody of something and she would have to try and decode it and then recommend a rendition. So you can sort of see that my first impression was that the songwriter was very important. And you have to remember, I'm just old enough. That's the important thing to kind of remember.
Is not that too old, just old enough. Yes.
The Beatles obviously really, we talk about Hank Williams obviously in the 50s. I didn't know Hank Williams' songs very well when I was that young. The Beatles really changed the whole music business because they wrote their own songs. And it was very unusual for performers to write their own songs, certainly in English music. There were fewer of those. And then it became the norm. So the two things were going along parallel. My observation of music, my knowledge of my family's involvement in music. My mother is in what you'd call here record retail. My father singing on a radio dance band. And again, bringing home sheet music. Well, the sheet music sort of made me feel, well, somebody was responsible for writing this song. I didn't just hear a song on the radio and go, oh, Johnny, Jimmy, Bobby, whoever that is singing, made that up. I kind of knew that he didn't make it up until John and Paul came along, and then we all knew that they were writing those songs, and they sort of stood out from the crowd. That's why I love Carole King. That's why I love Burt Bacharach so much, because those songs were incredibly popular in England. And they would quite often say, here's the new Burt Bacharach song.
you know, they wouldn't necessarily always say the name of the artist singing it first. And the curious nature of record releases in between America and England was that there was a little bit of time when the local act could have a hit with a new American song. So you would have Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas singing Wishing and Hoping, and then there would be the American version, which made the songwriter seem like an important kind of guy if he could have like two hits in the charts with the same title. Now, somewhere along the way, even when I started to play the instrument myself, I was drawn to particularly the band. Now, a group that had three of the greatest singers ever.
That's right.
But the guy that wrote the songs didn't sing.
That's right.
Robbie didn't sing. He sang a bit of harmony, but he didn't really feature as a lead vocalist.
Right.
And those two experiences of really always being very aware that the songs were created by somebody and getting to know the names of those songwriters and the fact that many of them had a fame that in some cases was superior to that of the people who sang those songs.
It's fascinating. I've always wondered, there was something about the alchemy of the band that I know Robbie wrote the songs, but clearly he was drawing on, there was something with that group that he was drawing on. There was some kind of...
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I'm sure an incredible thing to have not just Livon's anecdotal memory of Arkansas, but to have Rick Danko and Richard Manuel's voices to imagine melodies for, and the fact that they also wrote at that time in the earlier days, they also wrote melodies. Some of the most beautiful songs the band ever recorded were you know, Wheels on Fire is a Rick Danko melody, and Tears of Rage is a Richard Manuel melody with Bob Dylan. So, I mean, all of this seems very obscure maybe to people, but that's the way I learned it, because my father came from jazz, and therefore the songwriters of the previous generations, the music that my grandfather would have heard when he came to America in the 20s, the songs that have been handed down to us through the hands of jazz musicians and constantly reinvented, that made those songwriters seem like very important fellows. And that would be something that you'd want to get into that tradition, if not that business. And nobody could guess when you're just writing something in your bedroom whether you're going to get heard, much like whether you'd ever have a hit record or any such nonsense. You're not usually thinking that. And that's not what I'm trying to propose with this piece, is that this is, you might get to your dream, but you're not going to get to your riches. You probably wouldn't go into music now trying to get rich.
I mean, I can speak about comedy. I can't speak the way you can speak about music, but I can speak about, so many young people have approached me over the years and they said, I want to do what you do. I want to be famous. Mm-hmm. And I think, well, you just lost me. Because I swear to God, when I got involved in all of this, there was always a dream that I might become a known person doing it, and wouldn't that be kind of fun?
Yeah.
But what came first was the enthusiasm and the desire, and that came from watching everything from Monty Python to old Jack Benny to W.C. Fields to the Marx Brothers to... I think it works the same way in comedy and in music. I think they're very similar. It's a lot about rhythm and notes and timing, but it starts with, I've got to know this. And what you describe really beautifully in this audiobook is you talk about, for a while you had a guitar, this old beat up worthless Spanish guitar, but you never touched it. And then I think if your parents had hired a professor to come by and teach you the guitar, it would not have gone well. What happened was you heard this one song by Fleetwood Mac, Peter Green's song,
Man
of the World. Mm. And you thought, it got to you. And I know what you're talking about because I know that song. And it fits that this would be the song that you would hear that would make you think, I've got to get inside that tune somehow. And if it kills me, I'm going to learn how to play it on that shitty guitar over there on the wall.
It's a very odd thing that happened about that, because I came to understand when I got older and I got a little more fluent with one instrument, and that obviously I, not having any brothers and sisters, I only had my own experience apart from forming this group of, you know, subterfuge with my best friend. I never really understood that I had any kind of gift of an ear for music until I was much older. So I wasn't attracted to learning any of the three chord songs. I did actually, believe it or not, take classical guitar lessons for about 3 weeks and could not get along with the what they call tablature.
Yes, yes.
Which is a kind of way of notating the fingering of the guitar. I found that even more confusing than actual notated music and could not. It was like trying to trim your mustache in the mirror. And, you know, at 11, it was a bit unusual that I had that mustache in the first place. But I mean, but it really was, I just could not get to grips with it. And so back in the corner it went until I was 13 or 14, whatever age I was. 14, I think, when Man of the World came out. I was youngest in my year at school. And somebody probably in an upper year had the chord changes written out in chord symbols. And it really was like, I've said this story several times, but it is really true. It was almost like, have you seen this picture of Diana Dawes in her underwear? You know, it was like something furtive about it being, if you play these, if you put your fingers on the guitar, this sound will come out and you can do, and the words were written out with the chord shapes, drawn little boxes with where the fingers went. And I just studied and studied and studied. I realize now that the song is actually really complicated and a very odd song to pick as a novice one. So in writing this piece, I had to almost think my way back to what it would have felt like if I had, picked up the guitar and learned one chord, then a second. I think I had made that attempt once or twice and literally gone through the C to F roadblock and just thought, this is not for me. Maybe I can play the euphonium or something instead, coming from a line of...
I think you'd have had just as much success.
I'm not so sure. But some people would have said, yes, it would have kept this quiet more. That would have been a good thing. But I come from two generations of brass players, so that was the start of it. And that gave me quite a combination. And then I realized that learning the chords of Man of the World actually sort of really didn't lead me in the analogy of learning a flashy guitar solo. You just learn that one solo. You don't know any other songs or any other solos. I had to then humble myself to go back and go through the rudiments. But it was at that moment that I stumbled on this. If I start from a different place, I'll be able to play more songs more
this
readily.
This one song got you in the door.
Yeah, and that's really all I'm trying to do with this piece. I'm not on some mission to flood the world with millions of guitar players. That's a lot of competition for me. I'm still in the business.
We have enough.
Lots of extra guitar players out there trying to get the gigs. But I have tried to say it because at the end of it, all the other reasons why you play, that you play to give praise, to lament, to seduce... You know, you have to acknowledge some of the nefarious reasons why one might play instruments just to gain attention. Like you say, narcissism, that's part of it. Holding a guitar is great. If you have a big nose like me, Pete Townsend put it out, having a guitar in your hands distracts from having a large nose. I wore glasses.
Now, I'm curious what you think of the fact that famously there's the stories of the lads in Liverpool wanting to know what the B7 was, you know, and... No one knew how to make a B7.
Yeah.
And then I think, you know, George and Paul heard there's a bloke across town. If we take this bus and then that bus and then that bus, this guy will show us how to make a B7. Okay. And he did. And then they had that magical chord that you need to play pretty much every Elvis song from the Sun Session era. You've got to have the B7. And so it was a quest. It's like the Tolkien creatures trying to find the magical ring. They needed to find the B7. You describe in How to Play the Guitar and Why how we now live in this era, and I'm familiar with it because I've discovered it didn't exist when I was learning the guitar, but we now live in this era where I can pick any song off any of your albums and I can plug it into an app called Chordify. This is not an ad for Chordify. I'm not getting paid. And they will play the song, your song, and they'll show all the chords in time. Everything is right at our fingertips, but something might get lost
and also the feeling. And there is something really, I mean, I'm not saying, oh, it was better in the old days, but people will be familiar and probably still familiar if they frequent their local record emporium, you know, those places where there's still a record shop that's curated in some way. People say, no, not that record, that one. You need that one. that was part of the process too, of learning somebody to point you in the way, in the same way as the Beatles talk about somebody across town that knew B7 that liberated them to play those Elvis songs. I think there's something to that. I think the instantaneous availability doesn't come with it complete understanding. It's like getting a toothache and reading, you know, the possible causes of that toothache on the internet without a qualified medical doctor next to you. 20 minutes later, you've got a brain tumor, right? Or your leg is going to drop off. Or you've got some blood disease, right, or whatever it is. You can convince yourself of that with unqualified information. We don't even want to go into how bad unqualified information can be in the world. But in terms of simply playing music, it doesn't follow that just because everything is available, everything of value is understood.
Yes.
The very rarity of music, when I feel fortunate in a way, although it felt frustrating and I even wrote songs about it, that I had to tune in the radio at certain times of the day and week to hear the songs that I wanted to hear, it did make those moments when that record came on really stick with me. And the instant availability of it isn't necessarily preferable, because it makes you blasé about how easy. And that's all I'm trying to say. I'm not trying to say I know better than somebody much more skilled. There are more methodical ways one could learn. And I didn't set out to really write an instructional manual so much as ways not to prevent yourself from having the pleasure of playing. More importantly, just to play in the sense of a child, that you play without any embarrassment, without caution. You jump off things you shouldn't jump off when you were a kid, and then you learn better that, oh, I'm going to sprain my ankle if I do that. But you didn't half enjoy jumping off it when you were a kid, whatever the thing is. And that's what I'm trying to sort of remind myself as much as anything, even the age I am now, that this was, you know, I recorded this during the period where we couldn't travel around so much. And I've done a lot of work in that time. I don't know, I think we counted them up between my producer, Sebastian Chris, and myself. I think we've worked on 11 records worth of music. That includes remixing, you know, back catalog that have come out in the interim. We have 2 records that are prepared for release next year. And I think that was a reaction to not being able to go out and do my regular job, which is traveling around and playing the songs that I've gathered together over 45 years, maybe. But the responses to this interlude seem to be listening to, you know, choices were listening to like echoes, unreliable echoes, withdrawing and kind of sort of getting this wayface kind of mopey music coming out, singing songs about isolation that are not as good as John Lennon's Isolation, which is nearly every song written about isolation. You know? Or say, well, we're in a box that we didn't choose to be in.
Right.
Let's kick the fucking way out of here with whatever it is we do. Let's be alive to what we're doing. So, and I feel like if anybody listens to my daft ramble, I hope they enjoy the ridiculous aspects of it that I relate, that, you know, that like I really did want to learn to play April Come She Will, because I knew a girl called April, and then I thought maybe I could write a song about another girl I liked if I learnt minor chords, and then I discovered that that song's actually in a major key. I mean, all these things where you're mishearing, all the mistakes that you make along the way are all part of it, just as much as book learning, you know, and I think it's true of every subject, really. I've never yet used algebra in real life, but I still studied at a time. I think sometimes you're taught things to teach you how to learn.
I've used algebra several times during this interview.
Have you?
Yeah.
Yeah. It didn't show.
No, my mind works on so many levels, Elvis. You just couldn't believe it. You know, I would have to ask, you've had a very unusual experience, which is that you co-wrote songs with Paul McCartney. And I've thought, how did you not step outside yourself in that moment and think of the boy in London, Liverpool yourself, listening to this rock god, and now you're with him? Were you able to detach all of that and just get down to the business and do the work?
I actually was. I think that I've been around Paul enough, and I've seen it is a balance that I've seen some quite eminent people completely lose their minds in his company briefly. And I had to remind myself every day that I went to work to sit opposite him, like just as we're sitting here, only with two guitars and a couple of notebooks, that he hadn't hired a 9-year-old to come and write songs with him. You know, he didn't hire me in that sense, but I hadn't invited. He'd invited me, whatever age I was, 33 or 4 or something. Or maybe I was older than that. I can't even remember. You know, I was supposed to be there at that moment. I wasn't stepping into anybody's shoes. That would be, and you know, that is often, I think, the strange thing when there's a level of fame that probably very few of us can imagine, that people have a lot of dreams about those people. And I obviously imitated, I had briefly had one of those Beatle wigs when I was 8 or 9.
No, you know, really?
Plastic hat molded like hair. I mean, I also worked in a cosmetic.
I wish you still had that and wore it around.
No. Well, I mean, I think I wore it once and realized that it was such a hideous look.
Yeah.
I didn't even know who the Three Stooges were, but I looked like one of them. But
you look like Mo, I'm sure.
I look like, is it Mo? That
it's
I
look Mo.
Like?
You
I
look like
know,
Mo.
I didn't know this.
Mo was the Beatles before the Beatles. Yeah.
And then, you know, but the same way as when I worked for Elizabeth Arden, when I was writing my first record, I was still working in a day job. I could get cheap lipstick and mascara. You know, they had a company store where you could get the seconds. It never occurred to me to put it on. You know, I like during the glam era, I was working the back end of the glam era. It just, with this face, you know, we're both patties, you know, it just doesn't work. Uh-huh. It just doesn't work. Uh-huh. You know, it was sort of like this pasty kind of skin, like with then rouge on it, would just look awful.
Yes.
And it just never occurred to me to visualize myself in that kind of fantasy way. So I think, again, it's probably something to do with the fact that I saw how workaday making music could be through my father's experience. Mm-hmm. And then I had all the same kind of kid and teenage magic of like the first time I saw Marvin Gaye on television or the Supremes, you know, like they came over and there was a Ready Steady Go dedicated to Motown. Well, you call Motown, we call Tamla acts. And it was just like, oh yeah, so we can have like 4 lumpy lads from Bolton in Beatles suits, or we can have Stevie Wonder.
Yes.
You know, like suddenly another world exists that we didn't know about. And that keeps on happening. So I've been very, very fortunate in the people that I have worked with. I mean, this week, I have to tell you this because I think you'll appreciate it. You mentioned Paul, who, that was the most wonderful thing. We wrote some really good songs. We recorded them together, which that part was thrilling to sit, you know, to write a song with Paul McCartney, go downstairs from his writing room into a studio and harmonize together.
Wow. Okay.
That was like one of the most, and those are by far the best versions of those songs. I would, at the risk of offending him, better than the versions he recorded of them, better than the versions I recorded of the ones that I cut. Like 2 days ago, I was at Capitol Studios, a mile from here, with a 30-piece orchestra and a rhythm section cutting 2 songs I wrote with Burt Bacharach.
Oh my God.
With Burt in the studio.
Yeah.
Now, you know, work out the arithmetic. I mean, he won't mind me saying he's 93 this year. And by the end of the day, I was completely exhausted from the intensity of singing those songs, trying to do my best, singing live in the booth with the 30-piece orchestra being conducted by Vince Mendoza, the ringery incredible rhythm section, and watching Burt stand up at the board and then go, bar 61, we've got to get that downbeat. Elvis, you're not singing the melody right at bar 12.
Jesus.
You know, and by the end of the day, we had these 2 beautiful songs we're going to issue next year as part of a package celebrating it'll be 21 years since Painted from Memory came out next year. And I thought, everything I ever wanted to be as a songwriter is embodied in being the lyricist for 2 Burt Bacharach songs. Realized at this level,
yes,
like at the highest possible level with the group, with musicians who were totally committed to the job in hand,
right.
And at the end of the day, when he came in to thank them, stood up and gave him a standing ovation.
Wow.
And I mean, that's about as emotional an experience as I've had in a studio.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of really magical things, but you know, I do feel fortunate that some of the things that I've dreamed of. This is a funny question that's proposed by journalists quite a lot. What would the 21 or 22-year-old you that say to the person that did this, that in with the implication that there's something you betrayed or
no.
that you didn't keep as a part of the pact. And I'm going, one, I could never have imagined most of the things that have happened to me. And many of the unusual things are sort of, they're not a side issue, because 15 songs with Paul McCartney, maybe as many as 30 songs written with Burt Bacharach, you know, a half a dozen songs written with Alan Toussaint and the numerous other people I've collaborated with, is not the main part of my output as a songwriter. That's hundreds of songs that I wrote on my own and play in shows to this day. I'm opening, you know, a tour next week. That's what I wanted to do all along. But nevertheless, in writing this piece, I don't know if anybody can learn to play the guitar from listening to me talk, but they can, I can maybe make people laugh about the fear they might have about not doing it.
Yes.
Because I've just been incredibly fortunate that all these things have unfolded from getting past that chord of F.
Yes. Know? Yes. What I really feel about this, how to play the guitar and why, is that it also has nothing to do with playing the guitar, which is really lovely. It's just nice. It's an hour and a half listen. It's also very funny. I can tell that part of you wanted to be a goon show comedian, or you wanted to make those sound effects. You wanted to play. You're doing that. Your philosophy's coming out. And the journey's coming out, which, you know, I'll go back to any journalist that says, what would the 20-year-old Elvis Costello think about what the, you know, 50-year-old Elvis Costello? It's a journey. You'd have no idea what they were talking about. Well, the 20-year-old would be...
We all look at old pictures and go, what was I thinking when I bought that shirt, those shoes,
yeah,
that
exactly.
haircut? We all have that moment. And I'm no different than that, of course. And there's something inherently ridiculous about playing rock and roll in a great way. That's why I say you have to keep the inner idiot. And there's no accident that the Beatles were... on Parlophone, the label that on which Peter Sellers recorded and the Goons recorded. I'm sure they were delighted to be in the studio with George Martin.
George Martin was the Goon Show producer.
He was the producer of those.
Yeah.
Spike Milligan, you know, is like somebody I just adored, you know, who is the less well-known of the Goons because Peter Sellers' fame as a movie actor. But as I said at the beginning, you know, the radio comedy is a very important part of just the ritual of living in England in those days, because we didn't have 24-hour rock and roll radio. So Sunday afternoons, there would be shows like Round the Horn. Well, Round the Horn, there's a great name for English. That explains English comedy right there.
Yep.
That man is called Kenneth Horne. Round the Horn suggests voyage. But the word horn itself is inherently double entendre, you know. So it's taken much further than that. The characters that appeared in Round the Horn included an outrageously gay couple that spoke in Palare, you know, in arcane gay slang. And they said the most unbelievable things in the 1960s when homosexuality was
illegal.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, it was illegal to be gay. So there was a subversive element of them infiltrating mainstream British comedy. And this guy played straight man to it, even though his name was Horn. It was inherently a joke right there, saying everybody in the face, pardon that, you know, that is a lot of English comedy, is what my father used to call bum, belly and Poe. That the jokes are essentially something to do with going to the toilet, your belly, either the size of it or the how euphonious it is, and the Poe, which is the chamber pot. So anything to do with bodily function is inherently
You've just described 32 years of my comedy career. I wanted to end, just speaking of comedy, if you did something for me, you probably won't remember this, but years and years ago, you recorded a piece for us which bashes and wobbles around the internet, and people bring it up to me all the time, a quick comedy sketch. And you were so funny in it. You're sitting there playing it very straight. And I play you Allison, and I urge people to look this up because you are so goddamn funny in this. I'm playing you Allison, and I'm playing it so soulfully, and I'm looking at your eyes, and I remembered how hard this was to shoot because I didn't think I could play this song to you, but I did, and I'm playing it, and I'm playing it very soulfully, and you're listening, and at just the right time, you reach over with wire cutters, you start cutting the strings on my guitar. And then there's a pause, and I look at you and you look at me, and I start to about to go strum again, and you reach over and cut
the remaining string.
Please go look at that. It is
It's very hard to do that kind of thing. I mean,
I think it's
like the Marx Brothers. You mentioned the Marx Brothers, you know, and the Beatles having that legend of 10,000 hours or whatever it's supposed to be. That will look. The reason the Marx Brothers could walk up, that Harpo could walk up to somebody, pull their tie out, pull shears and cut it.
Yeah.
That's years of being in vaudeville to do that. Have you ever tried to cut somebody's tie off?
It's not easy. And they get angry.
They get angry quickly. And it's around the neck, and then you've got an angry red-faced person coming at you.
Yeah.
And really, the only thing to do then is kill them.
Oh, and you have to. And I've done it. Yeah. Well, look up that clip, please, people, because you are a vaudevillian in that moment. Your timing was absolutely fantastic, and that clip keeps coming back as some of people's... You know, 30 years of me doing late night comedy, and people still say to me, when you tried to play Allison for Elvis Costello and he cut the strings on your guitar, and how quietly and with great dignity you do it. It's one of my favorite things. I'm going to wrap this up, but this is an unequivocal joy for me to get to talk to you. You're just one of my all-time favorite artists, and you're so thoughtful about everything that you've done and the complexity of it all. I think it comes off beautifully in how to play the guitar and why. And I was so excited today. I've never done this, but I brought my 1946.
Can I see it?
Yeah, you can. It's right here. You don't have to strum it or anything.
No,
but
I
don't
like to strum it. But I've been looking at it throughout the...
I have an old Martin guitar, which is my prized possession. It's got no metal in the neck because... The U.S. had embargoed metal during World War II.
And this is from what year?
46. Oh. I just thought, I want that in the studio to absorb the magic.
I've been waiting a time just to talk to you. Been looking all down in the mouth and down at your shoes. Good baby, I've come to tell you the news. I'll paint rainbows all over your blues. Heard you've been spending a lot of your time up in your room. And at night you've been listening to the dark side of the moon. You don't talk to nobody if they don't talk to you. So I came here to sing you a tune. I give up is really all you have to say. It's time to find a brand new style, 'cause this really ain't the way. Let's go for a ride on my trampoline. I can show you the prettiest mountains that you've ever seen. Let's run to your closet, put on your blue suede shoes. I paint rainbows all over your blues. I paint rainbows all over your blues.
Okay. Well, this is the happiest I've been in memory.
John B. Sebastian.
I love that man. I've met him many times.
One of the great songwriters in America. There's another one. And the Great American Songbook should contain the man that wrote Do You Believe in Magic?
Yes.
And... She's Still a Mystery and 6 o'clock and many, many others. You Didn't Have to Do It. And that beautiful song, just so easy to love and such a wonderful, wonderful voice.
Well, you somehow did that and then made it about someone else, which is a very gracious, beautiful thing to do.
I don't think he wrote the song about their line about Dark Side of the Moon. I put that one in as a current
You improved
reference.
On it.
And you didn't cut the strings off with the shears while I was doing it.
Guess what?
This is a beautiful
People guitar. Thought it was funny. When you stopped me from singing, if I had stopped you from singing and playing, people would kill me. Elvis Costello, a true honor to be in your presence. How to Play the Guitar and Why. If you have no interest in the guitar, listen to this. It's an hour and a half of your time. It's absolutely lovely, funny, sweet, evocative, poetic. Everything we need right now. So check it out. Elvis, thank you so much.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you.
Justin and so good. Thousands of summer deals at your Nordstrom Rack store. Save up to 60% on new arrivals from Vince, Rag & Bone, Adidas, Joe's, Marc Jacobs, and more. Great brands, great prices every day at Nordstrom Rack. But hurry for first dibs. Get your summer favorites up to 60% off at Nordstrom Rack today. Great brands, great prices. That's why you rack.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Okay, Conan, it's time for another review at the reviewers.
I love it when you are authoritative, David.
These
it's
are
hilarious.
All, thank you so much.
You can't even do it.
Oh, God.
These are all real 5-star reviews from fans about your podcast. If you out there would like to leave us a review, just go to Apple Podcasts and please rate and review 5 stars. The first review comes from Shreya, who writes...
Wait, did you just ask people to give us 5 stars?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we're not going to read a 1-star.
Yeah.
Maybe we should. Isn't that more honest?
No. Well,
I don't think we
want to
know.
Yeah. And what
it's
are,
probably people I know.
I can't
it's probably people I'm related to.
Your family.
Yeah. You hate.
It's like, hey, that's my brother, Neil. I think sometime we should read a 1-star review.
You will spiral. That would be a disaster.
Because now what if everyone listening to this goes and leaves a 1-star review and your ratings just.
Oh, I see. I refuse to listen. I'll only listen to 5 stars.
Great.
And plus there are cash prizes if you leave 5 stars.
Oh.
The previous was not true.
Oh.
All right. That was my lawyer.
Okay. First reviewer comes from Shreya, who writes, question. Hi, guys. This first line. Matt, I hope you read this. Well.
Sorry,
Shreya.
Shreya, Matt's on paternity leave, as it's called in the business. Go ahead.
I saw Conan's latest post on Instagram with David. His teeth look extremely white. Does he have fake teeth? Thanks, Shreya.
Ooh.
Do you have fake teeth or do I have fake teeth?
You.
What are fake teeth?
Teeth that are not real.
I don't understand what that is. What do you mean? Like dentures?
I guess.
Oh, veneers.
Veneers.
Oh, God. Oh, Jesus. Yeah. I've got some veneers on my.
Do you really?
Well, aren't your front teeth all fucked up?
Yes. Thank you. I grew up in Boston, Massachusetts in the 70s. I regularly got my face punched in. So, yes, I got veneers, but they're not big fake. I don't have big fake chompers. They're just on the front right here. Like the 4 teeth in the front have a nice little, you know, veneer on them. What do you think, David? So what do you guys think?
I think they're great. Yeah. They're great teeth.
Wait, is it really? Because you got them knocked out?
No, I didn't get them knocked out. Did you really think that people beat me? I was beaten up once.
I wouldn't be shocked.
I was beaten up once in 1981. We don't need to get into that. Boston's North End. Not important. They smashed my nose.
What did the doctor say about your nose?
My mother came to the emergency room and said, is my son's nose okay? And he said, okay, it's a bag of bones. He was British. Shout out if you're out there, Dr. Constable. Never forget that. Anyway, anyone listening to this can imagine why someone in the North End would want to beat the shit out of me. It was a couple of guys, to be honest with you. Actually, it was an entire village.
Oh. Keeps getting bigger.
They called my mother at work and they told her, your son was attacked by a mob. And her reaction was like, well, that makes sense.
Oh, my God.
Anywho, no, it's not because of that. But, you know, I grew up in that era where you drank. We had this drink called like Xarex that was pure sugar. I mean, it was a terrible time, the 70s. Kids, I know a lot of youngsters out there listen. Just be glad you didn't grow up in the 70s. And, you know, during the hostage crisis, I gnashed my teeth a lot. And during the Carter presidency in general, I compensated for his failed economic policies by just chewing a lot of sugar cubes. And so, yeah, I had some, I'm an honest person. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's of all the cosmetic work a man can have done, for me to have just a little bit of a porcelain veneer on the front teeth. I think that's fine. I also take very good care of my teeth. What's your name? Shreya?
Shreya.
Yeah, Shreya. I resent any implication that my teeth are nice and white because they are porcelain veneers. Yes, I'm sure that's 80% of the battle. But I also brush regularly. I also floss carefully.
and use various rinses, balms, creams, and ointments.
This is fascinating podcasting. This is gripping.
I think we cracked the riddle. Shreya, by asking a very personal and I think rude question, I gave you an honest answer, but also we found out that I was savagely beaten in the 70s in the North End by hundreds of people who set upon me.
Our next review comes from Going to Guides, who writes, "You are a joy and a delight. Just listen to the latest episode where you ponder products to endorse like Clooney and his tequila. A wine cooler or rosé wine was mentioned. What if you created a fizzy wine cooler that was not rosé pink, but Conan Pompadour orange? I, for one, would buy it by the case. Anywho, I love you, Conan, and I get so happy when I see there's a new podcast episode to listen to. Let me know when the Coco Zay is ready to buy. XOXO, Shannon."
Coco Zay.
I wish she had said XOXO,
Gossip Girl.
I know. Shannon, you know who would love this is my manager, Gavin Pallone, constantly begging me, why aren't I doing some kind of big product integration that's going to make him a billionaire? And, you know, and he really was fascinated. Like, you see what Clooney has this tequila. You know, he and Randy Gerber, and they sold the company for $1 billion. And I think, right, that's George Clooney. Mm-hmm. Nobody, like, that's a very, very handsome movie star. And people want to emulate what he's doing. There's not a goddamn person in America who's like, how do I capture that Conan magic with the ladies?
Shannon.
No, Shannon, that's very nice of you, but I swear to God, no one, when they saddle up to the bar, says, what does Conan O'Brien drink? That's the drink for me. Or, what's he wearing? I've got to wear a Conan O'Brien suit. That says, this is a man who means business. Now, fizzy wine cooler probably kind of works.
Yeah, it does.
And an orange, and she had a pitch for the cocoa, what?
Coco Zay.
Coco Zay.
Conan Pompadour orange.
I like Coco Zay.
But I honestly don't see, and this is not me being hard on myself. This is me being completely honest. I don't see anyone linking me to a product that's meant for socializing, having drinks. You know what I mean?
I don't know.
Who's going to say, let's get a Coco Zay? Seriously, something.
I think it's going to be funny. I think people will do it not to be like cool, but to be funny. Like, hey, I'll have a Coco Zay and an orange drink, fizzy drink shows up. Like, that's funny.
I don't know that people buy liquor because it's funny.
Yeah, maybe not.
I don't think so. And so I think like a bubblegum cigarette.
What?
You know, what about like a pompadour wig for Halloween?
Just that like a one-time, one-seasonal thing? You're not going to make that much money. You'll make like $4. And then Gavin will not be happy.
The best idea I've heard is a hair product.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like a pomade or something. A Conan pomade.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, but then again, I think I've been sticking with this hairstyle that I came up with like in the 80s, just because I realized my hair could do it. And that's the only reason I did it. No one's ever emulated it. No one's ever said, you know, Jennifer Aniston, people wanted the Rachel. You know, George Clooney had that Caesar do or whatever he had on ER and everybody wanted it. No one, I've been sticking with this for like 35 years. Not one person has ever said, get me some of that.
No one's ever gone
to a barber and said, give me a Conan.
Yeah.
No one, not one person. So why is anyone going to buy the Conan pomade? They're not. There's not one product I can think of. And I implore my listeners, if you think there's a product that lines up with me, pitch it. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll even cut you in. But I want it to be something realistic, not a joke like I get a toilet seat. You know, no. Okay. Why are you guys laughing?
Furniture.
No, no one wants to sit like Conan.
What would the furniture be?
I don't know. I was thinking about Lenny Kravitz. He just did a thing with, I think, Crate and Barrel.
He's Lenny Kravitz.
So cool.
He's cool.
He is so cool. I'll buy anything Lenny Kravitz tells me to buy.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. Well, it's a little extreme.
Oh, I love Lenny Kravitz.
Oh, yeah. Lenny Kravitz smoke
that's
detector.
Cool.
Yeah, that's
cool.
Great. I want the carbon monoxide detector Lenny Kravitz designed. No, I want one that's made that's approved, you know, by OSHA.
Oh, Blaise says sunscreen.
Oh.
Sunscreen has been pitched. But again, I don't think anybody wants to look like me. I'm freckled.
There's a lot of people who have your complexion who are like, what is the best sun protection? And then if they see your face on a bottle, they'll be like, that must be real good stuff.
Yeah.
Because he's still alive.
Still alive. I don't know. We've got to crack this because I do want a product that's just selling out on shelves and the money's just rolling in and I'm going to get a Bentley.
Yeah.
And I'm going to wear a yachting cap and just be an incredible douchebag. Just drive around and be like, the money's just pouring in from the sunscreen, the pomade, and the Coco Zé. And I want to be really obnoxious about it. Just constantly be dropping, you have no idea how much money's coming in from that sunscreen.
Oh, no.
And guess what? It doesn't even prevent cancer.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we did something so it just doesn't even function properly.
You're saying this publicly?
Well, I shouldn't. I forgot that this was a podcast.
Oh, okay.
I thought we were just talking in a car. Sometimes I forget. Listen, if I do come out with a sunscreen, I do promise it'll provide some protection.
Wow, you're really selling it.
Yeah.
Sun cancer. The numbers, the SPF may be inaccurate, but by the time they track that down, I'll be out of the country.
Okay.
I'll say it's a 50 when it's like a 15, you know?
Wow.
But it'll smell like coconut.
Okay. Thank you to all our reviewers today. And if you'd like to leave us a review, please go to Apple Podcasts and rate and review 5 stars. We might just read your review on the air.
Conan O'Brien needs a friend. With Conan O'Brien, Sonam Ovsesian, and Matt Gourley. Produced by me, Matt Gourley. Executive produced by Adam Sachs, Joanna Solitaroff, and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Theme song by The White Stripes. Incidental music by Jimmy Vivino. Take it away, Jimmy. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, and our associate talent producer is Jennifer Samples. Engineering by Will Beckton. Talent booking by Paula Davis, Gina Batista, and Britt Kahn. You can rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts, and you might find your review read on a future episode. Got a question for Conan? Call the Team Coco hotline at 323-451-2821 and leave a message. It, too, could be featured on a future episode. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded.
This episode was produced and edited by me, Brett Morris.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Justin and so good. Thousands of summer deals at your Nordstrom Rack store. Save up to 60% on new arrivals from Vince, Rag & Bone, Adidas, Joe's, Marc Jacobs, and more. Great brands, great prices every day at Nordstrom Rack. But hurry for first dibs. Get your summer favorites up to 60% off at Nordstrom Rack today. Great brands, great prices. That's why you rack.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.